Welcome, everybody. I said 12:20. We're a couple minutes after that, but we want to welcome Professor Alex Schwartz of the New School. And for an hour and a half delay, that's not bad. let's move on. I think you all have the bio. I'll make it pretty short so we can get started, but give Alex a few minutes just to kind of relax and get situated. Alex Schwartz is professor at the Milano School of International Affairs, Management, and Urban Policy at the New School and program chair of the Department of Urban Policy Analysis. Former chair of the Department of Urban Policy Analysis from 2001 to 2012. He holds a doctorate in urban planning from Rutgers University in planning and policy development. And his principal areas of research, as many of you know, are housing and community development, including affordable housing programs, fair housing, community development corporations. While his research is focused on housing in the U.S., his most recent work compares housing policy in the United States with the United Kingdom, which will become even more interesting through all the changes that will be going on. He's the author of Housing Policy in the United States, third edition, and articles have appeared in Cityscape, the Economic Development Quarterly, Journal of American Planning Association, Housing Studies, and he's managing editor of North America of the International Journal Housing Studies. So, Alex, welcome to Pitt, and good to see you.
Welcome to
our graduate school, and we're going to be a really interesting audience. I say when you have questions, if you want to have, we always welcome clarifying questions during the talk, longer discussion questions afterwards.
Okay, so just since we're starting late, give me a sense of how
close, one.
One, okay,
yeah, and
sounds good.
Everybody, we plan, so I think, and we can stay, lots of folks can stay a little bit longer, so we're not under any pressure.
Very good.
And I think everyone's going to be looking forward to learning about Mayor de Blasio's affordable housing.
Great. Thank you so much, Sabino. Thank you. Can you hear me? Okay, great. So thanks again for inviting me. It really is a pleasure to be here. How many of you are from New York or been to New York? A few. Okay, good. So I'm going to be talking about New York City's housing plan, putting it, this is just giving you some context of some of the various pressures on the city. So these are from headlines from the last year or so. Manhattan apartments near average price of $1 million, almost 40% or more of sales are by cash, people, without even taking out a mortgage. Residential construction is at a high. The city's affordable housing plan has also been very robust in starting housing. Yet, homelessness continues to be a big concern. So what I'm going to do is provide a little bit of context of New York's housing situation and a quick overview of de Blasio's plan in the context of the preceding housing plans, which go back to the 1980s under Mayor Koch. I'll talk a little bit about some of the specifics of the plan, the achievements to date, and then conclude with some discussion about some of the key challenges that the plan faces. So, New York, is booming. Their population is now, disappearing. So, 8.5 million, which is, like 1.5 million more than it was not too long ago in the 70s. There's construction all over the place, investment across the city. So, it's not just, Manhattan. Brooklyn is booming all over, spilling over into Queens. Now the South Bronx is seeing a lot of investment that we never saw before. Land prices are extremely high, which is a big issue, and a very complicated one. And, not surprisingly, housing prices, are high and rising, rents as well as sales prices. Just to give you a quick sense, median sales price for, co-op condo, around $1 million. This says a little bit less for a condo, which I'm actually not sure I believe. The rents, $1,300 for a rent-regulated apartment, $1,600 a month for a non-regulated apartment. As you can see, construction, especially since 2015, is booming at 50,000 starts or housing units authorized for construction. A lot more construction of affordable units under the city's plans. This is a lot of text, but I think it's interesting. You're talking about desperately needed million-dollar one-bedroom condos. This is from a real estate article section of the New York Times. It says, the soaring land costs have made it difficult, to produce a $1.2 million one-bedroom apartment, which is desperately needed. You could argue that many people in New York can't come close to affording an apartment for $1.2 million. The city still has a high poverty rate, 21%. Renter income is far less than owner income. Almost a quarter of all renters make less than $20,000. Homelessness continues to be a huge issue. 60,000 people are in the homeless system in New York. That's not counting people that are, sleeping on the streets and the like. 60,000 could be a city in and of itself. So wide array of reasons for the city's, affordability crisis. The city, by the way, has officially been in a housing crisis since World War II. The legislation defines a housing crisis at 5% vacancy rate or less, which is the threshold that allows for continued rent regulation. So we're seeing, obviously, low rents, low incomes, rents are rising. You have a shrinkage of units that are affordable to people with lower incomes. Very high demand for housing, luxury housing, second homes. You have private investors buying up rent-regulated housing. They call it predatory equity, which has produced a lot of concern about tenant harassment and displacement. I'll talk a little bit more about that. Construction costs are high, land costs are high, and there's not a lot of help from the federal government, as there isn't anywhere in this country right now. So just to give you a little bit of data, this New York City has something called the Housing Vacancy Survey, which is done by the U.S. Census every 2 or 3 years, and this is done officially to ascertain that the city still has a rental emergency in the sense of vacancy rates being no more than 5%, but it also provides lots of other information. So this is showing you from 2011 to 14 changes in the number of rental units by rent level. And you can see units renting for less than $1,000, have gone down by over 100,000 units. Units renting for more than $2,500 have increased just in those 3 years by 36%, an increase of 60,000 units. So you can see this bifurcation. Rental vacancy rates. Overall, in 2014, which is the last year that the housing vacancy survey came out, 3.45, if you're less than $800 rent, it's less than 2% vacancy rate. So essentially, for units that are affordable for people in the lowest income range, it's very hard to find units that are available. It's only when you get to those higher end apartments is the vacancy rate, above 20, above 5%, really. And one factor is, New York City has rent stabilization, rent regulation. It's one of the few places left in the country with rent regulation. There's been a net loss of over 150,000 units of rent-regulated housing from 94 to 2012. It's gone down further. Units that are rent regulated may or may not be affordable for people earning, lower incomes, but when they're not regulated, the landlord can raise rent to any level. And so that is one factor among many. This just shows that, incomes, rental incomes have grown far less and in some cases decreased relative to 2005, whereas rents, median rents, have continued to increase. So there's just on average, at the median, there's a greater and greater disparity between rents and incomes. In terms of just overall measure of affordability, the average contract rent, not including utilities, rent-to-income ratio is 31%. You know, it's, on average, 30% is supposed to be affordable. Anything above is supposed to be less, not affordable, and you have almost a third of all renters paying half of their income on housing, on contract rent, which doesn't include utilities. So again, homelessness has been an incredibly challenging issue in recent years, more than 60,000 over a year ago. And the city continues to struggle with this issue. So now I'm going to shift to talk about the city's housing programs. So I mentioned, you know, in 1986, Mayor Koch announced what we called a capital budget program, where the city invested billions of dollars of its own money, capital budget money, in producing affordable housing. This was at a time when the city had acres and acres of abandoned buildings, the South Bronx, much of Brooklyn, Harlem, and these were properties that were owned by the city because of tax arrears. And the city invested, it said, millions and millions of dollars in rehabilitating these properties or building new buildings on vacant city-owned land, as well as spending lots of money in preserving housing, renovating occupied units. And this program continued to varying degrees under, you know, Mayors Koch, Dinkins, Giuliani, although to somewhat lower degree. Bloomberg went up again under new marketplace plan, and now de Blasio, so that's 5 mayors. Back around 1989, I think, the New School did a survey of the 51 largest cities and found the city, New York City, spent more money of its own resources on affordable housing than the next 50 largest cities combined. And we haven't updated that survey, but I doubt it's be very different. Most cities spend very little of their own money on affordable housing. They use federal money, block grants, tax credits, but to a very small degree do they invest their own capital budget or operating budget on affordable housing. So this is sort of the context. So de Blasio's plan is not unique. It just is an increase over what we saw before. So put it in context, this is showing annual housing starts under the different plans, starting with Mayor Koch. New construction, preservation, which usually means rehabilitation or in some cases renewing subsidies for buildings that are about to lose their subsidies. And you can see that in terms overall, de Blasio's plan is, you know, just under what Mayor Koch had, except there's much more in the way of new construction than we saw under Mayor Koch. That actually, under de Blasio, there's more new construction than in any of the other plans. In terms of preservation, it's also on the high side, although, again, less than what we saw under Mayor Koch, where they, again, had thousands of units that were rehabilitated. And so a total of 20,000 units created or preserved per year, compared to about 15,000 under Mayor Bloomberg. So it's an ambitious plan. This is an overview of...
A quick question, Ben.
Yeah.
With Koch, was that across the five boroughs, or were they more concentrated?
It's a good question. It was across the five boroughs, but there was an awful lot in the South Bronx, awful lot in parts of Brooklyn and Central Harlem, places where you had what we called in-rim housing, where landlords didn't pay their taxes, and the city had a policy of taking title to those properties after 1 year of arrears. The idea was that would be a disincentive for landlords to not pay their taxes. But instead, the city just became the biggest single landlord in the country after the New York City's Housing Authority. It owned, I forget the numbers, but something like 160,000 units of housing units because of tax arrears. And that was a problem, but it was also a resource. The city was able to build on that house, on that land, renovate those buildings. Now the city really doesn't own any appreciable number of formerly privately owned buildings that when owners go into arrears, and they're much less likely to do so now given the state of the housing market and the economy, but when they do, those properties usually get auctioned off. They don't get acquired by the city. So the city now, as I'll say in a couple of minutes, has to look at other strategies for constructing new affordable housing. The city had the existing land. It just had to invest money in restoring those properties or building new buildings on the vacant land. Now the city doesn't have those properties anymore. So this is Mayor Bloomberg's plan, the summary of what was called the New Marketplace plan, which went from 2003 to 2014. So 165,000 units either created or preserved, involving 500,000 people living in those units. $5.3 billion of city investment, and then overall investment of almost $24 billion. So this was at the time, probably still is, the largest municipal housing program in United States history. This is the de Blasio plan. Mayor de Blasio ran in part on the platform of supporting affordable housing, building more affordable housing. And the plan, the Housing New York plan, involves 200,000 units altogether, 80,000 of new construction, 120,000 of preservation. And again, preservation can be helping private owners renovate their buildings, upgrade their utility, their heating systems and the like. It can be renewing subsidies. It can be lots of different things. But it basically involves investment in existing buildings. It doesn't increase the total number of units. It just preserves their affordability versus new construction means creating additional units. The total cost is estimated to be about $41 billion over 10 years. 30 or so billion dollars for new construction, a lot less, $10 billion for preservation. In terms of income targeting, this has been an area of a lot of contention. Extremely low income means 30% or less of area median family income. Very low income is 50% to 30% of area median family income. This is 80 to 50%. And this would be above 80%. The criticism of the city, now I'm going to talk more about this, the criticism of the city's housing programs is that what they call affordable housing is often not affordable for the lower income residents, especially in places like the South Bronx and the lowest income neighborhoods. And partly this reflects the fact that the income subsidy programs, like the low income housing tax credit, isn't geared to people who are only making 30% or less of the area median family income, which is roughly tantamount to the poverty line. So de Blasio has designated a portion, so 20% of all of the units, and this is both preservation and construction, for people making less than 50% of area median family income. The Bloomberg plan doesn't even differentiate between these categories. It just says low income. So presumably most are probably around 50-60%, which is the area where you would be able to use the low income housing tax credit. So here's some more detail about the plan. So about $7 billion in public subsidy, of which $7 billion is from the city's own capital budget. Private money, about $30 billion. A lot of that is tax credit equity, private investors, often banks purchasing interest in limited partnerships in exchange for tax credits. A big part of the plan, which has been the most controversial, is that a lot of the new construction is premised on inclusionary zoning. I don't know if Pittsburgh has inclusionary zoning or Pennsylvania. So what this means is that in the case of New York, if an area is rezoned at higher density, larger size, the landlord or developer is required to set aside some portion of those units for lower income households. And this is becoming more and more common across the country. It started out mostly in the suburban areas where it's oftentimes a requirement across the board and in any development above a certain size. In New York, it's geared towards specific areas that are undergoing some kind of rezoning, either a neighborhood or even a builder looking to get a zoning variance for a specific site. So if you have an increase in density, you need to set aside affordable units. And I'll be talking more about that in a minute. The capital budget is much higher even than compared to Bloomberg, partly because of deeper income targeting, supporting lower income people. So last year, there was a series of very contentious hearings for the City Planning Commission, City Hall, about mandatory inclusionary zoning. A lot of controversy, a lot of protests, and a lot of it had to do with two concerns. One is that the units that are said to be affordable are not affordable, and the other concern is by changing the fabric of the neighborhood, increasing the density, you're fueling gentrification, causing house prices, rents to go up across the neighborhood. And so even though you might be setting aside some units that are affordable in these new buildings, units in other existing buildings are going to go up. That's the argument, and we'll talk more about that in a few minutes. So there was a lot of contention, and there was various compromises made in the final ordinance in terms of mandatory inclusionary zoning. So there are two basic options, 25% set aside. So 25% essentially of the units in the new building has to be affordable for someone making 60% of AMI, area median income, which is about $50,000 for a family of four. However, 10% of the units have to be earning no more than 40% of AMI, which is about $31,000. So this is, I think, unique in the country, having inclusionary zoning with such a designation. So it's harder to come up with make the finances work out when units are targeted for people with significantly lower incomes in terms of their ability to pay the operating costs of the building even. And there's another option, 30% earning an average of 80% of AMI. So a larger set aside in exchange for a higher income. In addition, under some circumstances, the City Council and or the City Planning Commission can set aside two other arrangements. 20% set aside, so somewhat fewer units, all for 40% of AMI, or in some cases, 30% set aside for higher, this would be in neighborhoods where it's harder to support the cross subsidies of the market rate units, where you have 115% of AMI with 5% required at lower levels. So this is the plan. Now, people seem to think that this is the de Blasio plan, but in fact, it's only part of it. A lot of the plan is about direct subsidies, the city using its own money to pay for new housing. Some other elements are worth mentioning. The city is investing a lot of money for free legal counsel in housing court, which is already started. There's current legislation. There was an article in the New York Times the other day to make legal counsel an entitlement for low-income renters. I know if any of you have read Matt Desmond's book about evicted, about the issues of eviction and how vulnerable lower-income renters are to eviction and homelessness and exacerbating all sorts of problems. And if you don't have a lawyer in housing court, you're far more likely to be evicted than if you do have a lawyer. And there's also a lot of harassment going on, landlords trying to evict people without proper cause. So now, already, we've had a sharp increase in tenants who are represented by legal counsel, and we've seen a decrease in eviction orders. I don't have the data, but it is available. And again, that's $60 million that comes out of the city's budget. They've also formed this task force with the state to investigate, enforce, and bring enforcement actions, including criminal charges against landlords harass tenants. And this is a big concern as prices and land values have escalated. You have rent regulation, so landlords, existing landlords and new property investors are very eager to convert units to market rate occupancy. And there's been a marked increase in harassment. Another point worthy of making is that the city is also spending its own resources on supporting the public housing system in New York City. In general, most cities are quite removed from their local housing authority. And New York City has the largest public housing program in the country, about 180,000 units. There's a huge deficit of unmet capital needs, about $18 billion. The public housing program is in pretty severe trouble right now, and the city is helping out in various ways, which is a fairly new development. And again, I would emphasize that the plan includes more targeting, including various kinds of direct rent subsidies for people who are in the extremely low income end of the spectrum. So I'm going to now talk a little bit of what's happened so far. So far in the last two and a half years, almost 53,000 starts, preservation and new construction, which is a quarter of the goal, of the 10-year goal. So right now the city is on target. There are some concerns. And I'll talk more about this, some of the resources that the city thought were available in the form of tax abatements or exemptions are not available right now. Some of these big numbers had to do with deals preserving very large existing developments, such as Stuyvesant Town, which was very big, but it was in jeopardy, and that's thousands of units. And they came to an arrangement to preserve many of those units. So if you didn't have those large sort of one-off deals, these numbers might be somewhat lower. This shows the data in terms of new construction preservation by income group. So you can see that a significant percentage of both new construction and preservation is going to extremely low income and very low income. So over 25% of all of the 17,000 starts are going to the lowest income groups. 25% of the preservation is also going to that group.
Just again, AMI is around what, 77?
Yeah, I think maybe around 80,000, I think, right now.
Okay.
Somebody
could be making 22,000 and they're 30%.
I see. I think I had some figures here. So 40% of AMI is 30,000. So 30% is probably 25,000 in that neighborhood. So there has been, accomplishment here, which we did not see under the previous plans. City is showing, it's 17,000 units in 2 years. This is a substantial gain, 36,000 of preservation units. So I'm going to talk now about some of the key challenges that the plan is facing, and feel free if you have questions. This is one. And I thought of having a subtitle of this talk with friends like this who needs enemies. The state, and it's not just about Governor Cuomo. There have been, from the beginning, there have been tensions and disputes between these two leaders of the city and the state, both Democrats, about all sorts of things, but including affordable housing. And the thing that came, thing that came up that's been most difficult is that there is a program called 421A, which is a very long-standing and imperfect rent property tax exemption. So when a developer builds housing, he gets an exemption on real estate taxes for a period of time. And this program has evolved and changed in various ways. And in recent years, housing in Manhattan and parts of Brooklyn have been required to, developers have been required to reserve units for affordability for lower income people. The authorization for this program expired a year or so ago. de Blasio had a plan to reform it so that it was more favorable for lower income people, somewhat less expensive, and it looked like it was actually going to pass until Cuomo basically put the kibosh on it. And he said, no, no, this isn't good. And he said that the Real Estate Board of New York, which is essentially the trade association of the largest real estate businesses in the city, and the construction trade workers unions had to negotiate and come up with a compromise. The concern was that some of the properties might not have union labor, or the wages might be less than what the unions would want. And so the idea was to have these two groups come up with a compromise, which they failed to arrive at. And so when that happened, when they failed to come to an agreement, this program has lapsed. And again, it's a flawed program, but the problem is land prices are extremely high in New York, and rental housing is taxed at a higher level than other kinds of real estate. And so that in many cases, it's impossible to make a property economically or financially viable without some kind of reduction in the property tax. And so what's happening now, the concern is developers are not going to build rental housing at all, but instead build condominiums. And so this has been, just one, probably the most blatant problem, but there are certain others as well. And the other issue is you have lots of regulations and programs require state approval, among other things, changes to rent regulation. And the state Senate, which has been Republican controlled, has always been hostile towards rent regulation. And so that's also a challenge in trying to reform rent regulation to make it harder, for example, to have landlords opt out of it through what's called luxury decontrol. So those are problems. So, the city doesn't have free rein in terms of its control over the various programs that operate within the city. So that's been one big challenge. The other is this. There was a lot of opposition to inclusionary zoning. You had various advocacy groups protesting. Community boards, the lowest level of government in New York City, also came out against rezonings and mandatory inclusionary zoning. And these were extremely contentious hearings that happened last year. And what's happened is the city approved, the ordinance authorizing mandatory inclusionary zoning, and they passed a rezoning of the East New York section of Brooklyn, which is a very large, low-density neighborhood, which has potential for building more development. It also has good transportation access. It's also very low income. But other neighborhoods have been fighting against rezoning or refusing proposals for rezoning for individual buildings which would have generated affordable housing. Most recently, in the Inwood section of Upper Manhattan. So it's very difficult to get approvals for the rezonings which would allow for these increases in affordable units. There are a number of reasons for this. One is people just don't like change. They don't like increased densities. They don't like the loss of sunlight, in some cases parking, which is a huge issue. And there are other programs involving parking, which I won't get into. They don't like just a change in the neighborhood fabric. So that sort of smacks a little bit of not in my backyard. So that's been part of it. And there's also concern, as I said before, that these rezonings and the inclusionary zone housing that comes about with it is not actually going to address the problem. Housing isn't affordable for people in East New York. It's going to generate more market pressures, which will drive up prices outside of these specific units and buildings. And so there's been a lot of unrest about this. Some people argue you shouldn't even bother building new housing, just focus on preserving it. or just build a very small number of units that are deeply affordable and not try to reach these large numbers of units, 200,000, you know, right now 80,000 new construction units under the plan. Some people say that's way too much, you should just have a far smaller number, yet the city has, you know, a vast affordability problem. And so I'm going to close by talking about some of the broader issues that I think this implies for local housing programs in general. You know, the city has done much more than anywhere else, you know, to try to deal with the issue of affordable housing and the fact that so many people, you know, are spending, you know, huge portions of their income on housing. You know, the city has produced hundreds of thousands of units over the last few decades. And yet, you know, the city continues to face, you know, a shortage. There's a huge, you know, huge problem of, you know, homelessness, people spending half of their income on rent. So right now, you know, the city, there's a, roughly speaking, 300 and so thousand people that are lucky enough to live in deeply subsidized units, public housing, project-based Section 8, or they have a voucher, federal, you know, housing choice voucher. But, you know, you have another, you know, roughly speaking, you know, 300,000 extremely low-income renters, and another, you know, almost 300,000 very low-income renters, you know, in the city, and most of them are paying more than 30% of their income, and many are paying, 65% of them are paying more than 50% of their income on rent. So in other words, if you have very low income, you're two out of three are going to be paying half of your income on housing. So you have a huge and acute problem of housing affordability. Federal government, which is, provides, you know, rent subsidies, you know, has not been doing it. The, you know, the number of rental vouchers issued in the United States has been basically flat. Number of public housing units has gone down. This is showing you the number of vouchers in circulation in New York City over the past 10 or so years. There are two categories. You know, NYCHA, the Public Housing Authority, has the largest voucher program. And you can see here that, you know, the number of vouchers has been almost unchanged since 2006. There's been a somewhat of an increase, you know, of these red vouchers. These are issued by the city's housing agency, HPD, and these units are usually attached to specific buildings that the city has financed. Many of them are for supportive housing and other kinds of projects. So the city can allocate vouchers to some of its developments. There's only been 23,000, you know, increase of 23,000 units, or rather vouchers, in this period of time. So virtually nothing, especially if you look at it, you know, on an annual basis. So, you know, I estimated, you know, again, using the housing vacancy survey, it would cost between, depending on how you do it, between $3 and $6 billion annually to relieve, you know, these hundreds of thousands of low-income renters of their housing cost burden, to basically do what the federal government does and limit their out-of-pocket expenses to 30% of income. You know, the city right now is spending $7.2 billion over 10 years, so $700 million a year, roughly, in its capital budget to meet its housing plan. If the city by itself were to address housing affordability, you would be spending, you know, orders of magnitude more. And this is just my rough estimate of what this would cost. So if you were to support everyone who is less than 80% of AMI, and you were to ensure that they would pay no more than 30% of their income, if you were wanted everyone who currently is paying more than 30% of their income now and provide the subsidy, it would be $5.4 billion approximately, or $454 million a month. If you're only going to help the people that are currently facing a severe housing cost burden, paying half of their income on rent, it would cost $4.6 billion a year. So, you know, that's just not realistic for a city government, or probably a state government to do. And politically, it would be quite problematic. And historically, this is what the federal government has done, providing these deep rental subsidies, but it's not doing it right now. And even if you were to go to just helping people who are, you know, in poverty, making 30% or less of AMI, and you were just to support those who are paying half of their income on rent, you still would cost $2.8 billion a year. So the point is, these numbers are huge, and it's probably similar in other cities as well around the country, what it would cost. Obviously, New York is the largest city, so the costs are bigger. But the arguments that some of the advocates are making, the city isn't doing enough to subsidize the lowest income people, it's true, they have the greatest needs, but the numbers are just gigantic. And another issue is, by using the inclusionary zoning, what it does, by leveraging private money to produce affordable units, the city's able to target its own money specifically for people who can't afford to live in the inclusionary properties. And by saying that the inclusionary zoning is insufficient, that you have to have deeper income targeting, you're reducing the total number of units or requiring the city to subsidize those units, and you have less money left over for subsidizing people with lower incomes. So I think I'm going to stop here and open up for questions.
Okay,
thanks.
Thanks, Aaron. Do identify yourself. So I know there's some housing professionals in the audience who will see what some of the questions are. Michael?
I'm Michael Glass. I've got a question about the leveraging of private funds to help stimulate extra housing supply. What's the city doing to try and avoid a Stuytown case in which, you know, Tishman was trying to use luxury deregulation to recoup their sale price?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the last.
So, the affordable housing units that are built, given inclusionary zoning, what sort of protections are there?
Good question. I believe there's permanent affordability is required.
Okay.
And that was part of the language. So it does stand out from other inclusionary programs. They are required to be perpetually affordable to prevent people from converting to market rate 10, 20 years later.
David Green from the Urban League of Great Pittsburgh. I just had a question of, to what degree, and obviously there's some huge financial challenges here, but to what degree is racial segregation one of the movers here? Because it's beyond just not wanting to be able to live in the neighborhood, it's wanting to not wanting to actually be in the neighborhood at all. Because simultaneously with this, there's also, pushback against having schools.
Yeah.
There's a school integration plan that they're doing because they have high population in one and low in another.
Right.
And you know, Jason Jones, The Daily Show has been one of the people who's been outspoken about wanting to preserve the kind of segregated.
That's an interesting question. There's a lawsuit right now. Right now, the city provides what's called neighborhood preferences. So when a new property opens up, a new affordable unit, preference goes to local residents, so that a certain percentage of the units are supposed to go to local residents. And fair housing advocates say that violates the fair housing law in that it means that you are perpetuating segregation, that people from other neighborhoods should move in. Other people in New York say, you know, you have people living in these neighborhoods, they've been starved of resources. Now that resources are coming in, you're saying that local residents shouldn't be able to take advantage of it. But that's been a very big concern. And we don't know yet what's going to happen. This, I guess San Francisco is also dealing with these issues as well. New York is segregated. Most of the, most but not all of the neighborhoods that are being targeted are predominantly minority, but there's certainly neighborhoods in Manhattan and others that, you know, are, you know, much more integrated or predominantly white that occasionally do see affordable units coming in. mostly through things like inclusionary zoning, or when they had the tax abatement program at 421A, you could have luxury high rises with a set aside of 20% units for people of lower income. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Leanna from Urban League Housing.
Hi.
Pittsburgh is also in a crisis of affordable housing, and I noticed you said a statement that you're receiving less federal assistance. So are you saying that HUD, I know HUD is a big factor in affordable housing, are you saying you're getting less?
No, well, it's huge in that, you know, there's all sorts of issues. One is, you know, public housing, which in New York has not demolished its public housing, unlike most other cities, big cities. But it's being starved of resources and it's deteriorating. There are lots of issues there. The voucher program, you know, has very slightly increased. And when you have things like continuing resolutions where funding is sort of flatlined, it means that it often results in a reduction in number of voucher holders. And, you know, the government has not been funding the Section 8 program. You know, it's basically been static. And you would need a very significant rise to address the affordability problem. You know, and vouchers don't work in all contexts, but they certainly can work in many cases. And I suspect in Pittsburgh they would be very helpful. But when you don't have them, the onus is on the city to come up with something. And it's, you know, it's essentially, I guess one other point I'll make is, in New York, it costs something like $600 to $800 just to operate a building, to pay for the basic carrying costs, not including debt service. And many low-income people can't afford that. So it's basically impossible for them to afford the rent in an affordable building because they can't afford to pay for the mortgage at all. And, you know, so you need the rent subsidy just to make it possible for someone to live in a proper, in a building, even, you know, without counting the cost of building it. So anyway, it's a huge issue.
Hi, yeah. My name is Jean Jones Seals. I found a slide interesting about property taxes and how developers might be choosing to build condominiums over rental properties because of some tax policies. Can you shed some light or have any information to provide any perhaps unintended consequences of losing commercial retail, I mean commercial developments, such that they're kind of maybe building more of a business sector and creating jobs, but yet you don't have the housing?
Yeah. So this is also residential, what I'm talking about. It's just, it'd be condominium rather than rental housing. And, you know, New York's property tax system is incredibly complicated, and I think everyone admits it's a disaster. And there are all sorts of different adjustments that are made, partly things like these, you know, tax exemptions. But it just shows that one effect of this very convoluted, you know, system is that it makes it much harder to build rental housing. So I'm not sure if I'm really answering your question.
If taking inspiration of all residential construction, my residential, so it's not only rentals competing with condominiums versus co-op,
right,
but residential housing or residential construction period is competing with commercial.
Yeah, I think in the case of New York, in many cases, you make so much more money from rent from residential that you don't have that quite as much. Maybe certain parts of Manhattan there's an interest in building offices, but right now we have displacement of commercial being converted to residential, especially for things like manufacturing. But even I think sort of certain kinds of office and other non-residential uses, there's such demand for space, and you know you can generate on a per square foot basis much more revenue from residential use than non-residential use. So that may be particular to New York. I can imagine other places you could have more sort of competition between office or hotel and residential. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Marty Allerser, Pittsburgh United. We have an affordable housing campaign that's working to establish a trust fund in Pittsburgh. We're facing about 20,000 low and very low and extremely low income units missing. We have about a third of the vouchers people can't use because they can't find locations in the city or the first suburbs. And we're really looking at a strategy that targets the extremely low income for about half of the housing trust fund monies, up to 50% for another 25%, and then home ownership from 50 to 80%. And the estimate is that if we're smart and don't put it into new construction very much, that we're going to look at over 10 years maybe addressing about a third of the gap. But our struggles are in a couple of ways. I mean, we're looking at funding it through a realty transfer tax. And one of the things we've noticed is that there's one city in the United States that actually uses that source, and that's Washington, D.C. The federal legislature is not as susceptible to the realtor association power.
And I think Florida does it.
So state, 38 states use RTT, and the federal government uses RTT, but the Realtor Association is so powerful at a local level that it's stopped it in every other city in the United States. So I'm wondering if New York is looking at that. It sounds like at the state level, you're not doing very well with the Realty Association and the trade unions becoming a block. The other question I would raise is that, you know, we noticed that there wasn't a single mention in either convention, although one of them, I guess, we could expect, but there wasn't a single mention in the Democratic convention of affordable housing. And it's one of the strategies nationally that we think cities really need to be focused on. We're part of a network called the Partnership of Working Families. It's got 17 cities, including New York, a group called Align in New York that's really trying to struggle around making this a federal priority. I'm wondering if the Realty Association is a factor in New York, and also if there's any thought about how we take city problems and get them in the first 100 days of the new administration.
Good questions. I'm not aware that the real estate industry has been that much of a factor. It's more the development side, you know, the developers rather than the sellers of the real estate that are factors. The trust fund, there is a trust fund in New York, but it's fairly small, and I don't think there, I've not seen proposals to create ones like what you describe. I think New York State has one, but it's very small. It's interesting, you know, Hillary Clinton in the op-ed in the Times about poverty mentioned housing, but she focused exclusively on the low-income housing tax credit, which is, you know, important, but it does not target where the need is greatest, and especially in weaker market areas. You know, you could argue you don't really need the tax credit. You don't need more supply, and in many cases, the rents and tax credit housing, it's about the same as market rate rents. Where the need is, and, you know, Matt Desmond's book, I think, really demonstrates this very vividly, is for people who can't afford the tax credit rents. Well, you need vouchers. You need more public housing. Public housing is like, you know, no one wants to embrace it right now in the United States, unfortunately. But the voucher program, which overall is successful, it certainly have issues of being able to use, you know, there haven't been studies of its success rates since like 2000. So in certain neighborhoods, it doesn't work very well. For certain kinds of households, it doesn't work very well. But, you know, you need to have vouchers or place-based, project-based vouchers would do a lot more, and the Democrats aren't talking about that, and I agree that's a big problem. As far as cities, you know, unfortunately they aren't as big a constituency anymore. So, you know, there's been talk about trying to have some kinds of coalitions with inner ring suburbs. It's very obviously very difficult, but the affordability issues though are much more than just urban. You know, they span, you know, suburban and rural. So maybe looking at that as a basis of coalition versus just focusing on cities might be more effective, but it's certainly not easy. In the back there, yeah.
Maria Metcalf, work for the city of Pittsburgh. Hi. I'm also a graduate student here in the University of Pittsburgh. Piggyback off of the comment about the Real Estate Association. As an African American, I can put out all my challenges to try and find housing here, even the amount of money that I make here in the city of Pittsburgh. I was curious about your tenant and harassment task force slide, and I was trying to figure out how that evolved. Is it going to be developed further, or is that something that was new or something that's existing?
Yeah, it's fairly new, and I don't know a lot about it. You know, there's been a lot of concern about harassment. I mean, you have people are buying up these lower income buildings, rent regulated, and there's no way that their investment would pay off given the cash flow of the building and given the fact that you have rent regulation which specifies to what degree rents can go up. So it's basically predicated on harassment and getting these tenants out. And there's been lots of, you know, articles about very blatant forms of it and not so blatant forms of it. And some of it is clearly illegal. And so the city, in collaboration with the Attorney General and the governor, are, you know, looking at these and in some cases have pressed charges to try to, one, you know, try to do something about it and also send a signal to investors that this is not going to be tolerated. And it's fairly new. It's in the last 6 months.
My name is James Reed. I'm a graduate student at the Heinz College of Carnegie Mellon. Just wanted to ask if you could talk a little bit more about the funding mechanisms that are being employed to, for the mayor's housing plan.
Sure. So the main part is you have the capital budget. So the city has money that it borrows, right? You know, paying for schools and infrastructure, and a part of that money is designated, you know, for housing. It also it takes out basically tax exempt bonds to use for various housing purposes, and it's unusual. Most cities don't do that. It also, I believe, now takes out taxable bonds. And also uses that, and with these tax-exempt bonds, it piggybacks with what are called 4% low-income housing tax credits, and that generates additional subsidy. The city is also using some money from its expense budget in various ways to help pay for various things, including, I think, some rent subsidies. You have the city has a housing finance agency called the Housing Development Corporation, which issues a lot of these bonds, and also has various programs, you know, also uses federal block grants for a lot of this work as well. So I don't know if that, I think that answers the question. Yeah. And, yep?
Yeah, here's Trevor from the Housing Authority of the City of Pittsburgh. Just a comment and a question. One is that, you know, geographic preferences have been fairly consistently determined as violations of the Fair Housing Act. So I do think that could become an issue in Pittsburgh and some of the developments and things that are proposed in some neighborhoods. I did want to ask two things. One is there, we've talked about a phenomenon of people renting down, you know, people renting, they can afford a more expensive unit, but they're renting a less expensive. Is that a significant factor in New York, especially if the rent stabilized?
Yeah, it definitely can be. You know, there are, you know, people love to talk about, you know, well-to-do people in rent stabilized housing. That's, for the most part, that's not true, but there are exceptions to that. This graph just shows that, you know, you have 900, this is going back a little bit, 2010, about 1 million households who are extremely low income and very low income competing for 425,000 units that are affordable to them. And some of these units might actually be occupied by people of higher incomes. I haven't done that analysis for New York. I'm sure it's true to some degree. You know, the longer you've been in a unit, especially if it's rent stabilized, it's possible that your incomes may go up. But I don't think it's a big part of the problem. There have been some efforts in public housing to move people around, like to move. It's more about getting people out of larger units when their children have moved out and freeing up units for larger families. And had, you know, mixed success with that.
And just the second question was, we were talking about Mayor Koch's plan, mm-hmm. and the success, yeah, he had, that part of that was because of there was tax delinquent city-owned property, mm-hmm. and land that he was able to take advantage of. Does that suggest that at Pittsburgh, where we do have still quite a lot of vacant or city-owned tax delinquent property, that we should really focus on that opportunity while it's still here before it's...
I mean, it's a resource. I mean, obviously, there, you know, you have to be able to do it well. And in some cases, the city was an abysmal landlord when you had occupied units that were owned by the city. They were in terrible shape, and the city was a terrible landlord in many ways. But it was able to fix up those units. And because of the city's investments, the South Bronx in particular is unrecognizable. You know, it really is a different place. And it's almost all because you had the city in partnership with various nonprofits rebuilding neighborhoods. And so it is a resource, and it's much more difficult when markets turn to be able to buy, to buy property. Even in East New York now, investors have gone and bought up a lot of these properties in anticipation of new investment. And so if you already own the land, and if it's well situated, it is probably something worth looking at. Yeah?
One more question I also had. Harry Bethlehem, the city of Pittsburgh. I also administer what we call the disruptive property limits for the city of Pittsburgh. So what I'm running into a lot is a lot of tenants who are using just traffic payment as a means to supplement their income to be able to afford the limit. So have you come across any data in your research that shows how crime is being affected by the housing?
That's an interesting question. I don't. I mean, the crime overall in New York has gone way down, which isn't to say it's disappeared, but I don't know the relationship between housing prices and crime. It's an interesting question.
Okay. One more question? Mm-hmm.
I'm Nick Durek. I'm a housing economic consultant at Online Associates, also living in New York. And I was wondering if there's been any research on the relationship between the mandatory and the policy and the actual arguments about
the community policy. I'm sorry, between mandatory inclusionary zoning and what?
And the relationship, so, as engineers, I think they're talking a lot about the changing neighborhood fabric. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if there's
been
any research on the relationship between the new housing policy and actual community development and
the
neighborhood development, things they were
considering targeting. And if not, I think it's probably especially the larger scale rezonings, like in East New York, we don't know yet. There's been a lot of fear and there's been various speculations, but I think there will be research on that. But I think it's too new.
But what's your opinion?
I mean, I think that places like East New York, you have such strong development pressures and investments that gentrification is likely to occur anyway, that I think it's naive to think that this by itself is going to generate. It obviously adds pressure, but the city is also trying to do things such as providing legal counsel for housing court to try to address some of these problems. But it's a city that's growing. There's a lot of interest in internationally investing in the city, population growth. I don't see how you can avoid these pressures. And I think it's naive to think that this alone is causing it. If you didn't have inclusionary zoning, you wouldn't have, price appreciation and speculation and so on. So that's my inclination.
Alex, as the monitor, I'll take a last question, sure. And then we'll end. But in 5 years, where do you think things will be?
In New York? Depends a little bit on the election.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to think, I actually think that there's more recognition now about the affordable housing issues, especially people that are lower down the income spectrum. I think the Matt Desmond book has been is very powerful and has gotten people's attention. I'm hopeful that maybe to the extent there is any change that the people realize that, housing is, you simply can't afford it on a low income. And it generates lots of problems if you can't afford it. But, I can't say I'm that optimistic. I think that if the election goes one way, maybe there's a little bit of hope. But I think that it's clear that the cities on themselves, you can do certain things, but given the scale of the problem, it's basically impossible. And I think this really illustrates that, because the mayor of de Blasio is trying to do more in terms of addressing the needs for people at the lowest end of the income spectrum. But it's clearly not nearly enough, and there's no way the city could afford to do much more.
Okay. I want to thank Alan. Oh.